of the experiments and decided to finally write it up because there's quite a bit of interest in what happens in a magnetic field. Now, spectroscopy measurements in high magnetic fields are very rare. You can't do ARPAS in high magnetic field, for example. And certainly, neutron scattering is limited as well. So optics is a natural tool for this work. And this is work that was done mostly by Young Sik Hwang, who's now in Korea. And this is my Estonian group. They still have a magnet in Estonia. Some of this work was done by Jesse Hall in Estonia when he visited last year. And the crystals were grown in Toronto by actually Berginos' group. Berginos since then has had another career. And some of the crystals were measured also by David Hawthorne with DC transport, which I'll show you, in the same from the same batch that the crystals we're using came from. Now, here's the motivation. First of all, we built a complete new setup for high field optical measurements. So 18 Tesla in Toronto, 12 Tesla, a similar setup in Estonia for optical spectroscopy. And we wanted to, in this particular work, compare optical data with magneto resistance and neutron scattering. And another motivation for this was the reports of magneto oscillations in high magnetic fields. Now, those people that work in organic superconductors know that there is an effect called field-induced spin density waves. So when I saw these reports, I thought immediately that it's possible that these were not the ground state of the normal material, but were a new electronic state induced by the magnetic field. And since then, there's been quite a bit of theoretical work predicting that phenomenon of field-induced spin density waves in this material. So this was something we wanted to check up on. This is the new setup. I'll discuss it briefly. It starts with this special interferometer that is designed for very long wavelengths, because if you're working in magnetic fields, the natural energies are of the order of 1 or 2 millivolts. So you want to work in the same spectral region, which means they're very far infrared. And we have done some work on copper germinate, the transmission work, where we were able to see, for example, the electron spin resonance in the non-pyrrole state. So this is an ideal instrument for that work. And actually, I might mention that this instrument is built here, not far from here in London, Ontario, by a company, ScienceTech, and they ship these all over the world. Not too many of them, 1 or 2 a year, but it's a very important tool for long wavelength infrared work. This is the insert that we built for this work, and it has several important components. In order to make sensitive measurements at these long wavelengths, we have to have a helium-3 bolometer detector as close to the sample as possible. This detector is in situ. This is a cryostat that's filled with liquid helium, so this is submersed in liquid helium, and it has a separate helium-3 compartment with needle valves and charcoal pumps and the entire stuff that's needed, all included in this low-temperature region. There's also a filter wheel here that filters out high-temperature radiation to this sensitive detector. The sample sits here in the middle of the helium, in the middle of the magnet, and the sample holder is shown here. It has room for 4 samples at the end of cones, and in order to get a reference sample, we evaporate lead from evaporators on each sample. This thing rotates here with wheels from the top. The light comes in here on a light pipe, is reflected from the sample, and goes to the detectors, which are just right above here, in this position here. This is a unique system, and as far as I know, no one else can do these kinds of measurements. And I'm particularly distressed that the National Magnet Lab hasn't built anything close to this. They should have this because it would be very interesting to see what the properties of materials are in the 35 Tesla region, which is available for them. And I don't see any physics reason why they couldn't do this. It's a matter of, I don't know what, I've discussed this with Bobinger many times, but I don't seem to be making any progress. Okay, so what we're doing here is we're working at low frequencies from 1 to 30 millivolts. The upper frequency is limited here because of various optical limitations, but the lower frequency is around 1 millivolt. Well, the spectrometer will go lower, but it's not possible for us to work at the lower frequencies. High fields, 18 Tesla with a magnet. By the way, the Toronto magnet is now in Hamilton. We moved it there, and hopefully we'll start it up in the future again. And the temperatures are from 1.8 Kelvin for the sample up to about 60 Kelvin. If you go any higher than that, the bolometer gets overloaded. And so there are limits to this instrument. It's strictly a low-frequency instrument. And there's room for 4 samples and 4 evaporators. Okay, well, let me just discuss the situation of underdoped LSCO, the material we want to test with this system. Underdoped LSCO is the reason we picked the underdoped material is we want to go to a normal state. And we only have 18 Tesla, so that optimally doped materials would not be enough. So this is one proposed phase diagram for this material by Demler and Sachdev and Zhang. And the idea is that above a certain field, the material enters a spin density wave state with small Fermi pockets. This is HC2 here, but in the below HC2, there's a coexistence of superconductivity and spin density waves. Now, at higher doping levels, they propose that there's no coexistence and a normal large Fermi surface, without spin density waves is the state. Now, I don't know that anyone has looked at this region here, but our experiment is in this region here, in the low frequency region. We have, the low doping level region. Our TC in the examples we had is 5 Kelvin, and we can easily reach this point here and quite a bit higher. So we can go from the superconducting state to the normal state here. Now, there are other experiments that have been done in high magnetic fields, and in particular, neutron scattering. And here are results from Bella Lake, where they looked at a rather more highly doped sample. X equals 0.1, and TC is about 32 degrees. This is a superconducting transition temperature, and what's plotted here is a magnetic moment against temperature. And what they find is that in the zero field state, there is some magnetism that rises as you lower the temperature. But then as they turn on the field, they get this kind of very strong magnetism that looks like an order parameter behavior. And the starting point here, although you have to be a little bit careful with the way those points are plotted, it is sort of in the neighborhood of TC, that is a superconducting TC for this, what they consider to be a spin density wave state. And they go up to 14 Tesla here. But of course, this is much smaller than HC2 because they are at a rather high doping level. Their magnetization, as a function of field, the magnetization rises sort of and seems to saturate around 15 Tesla. But it's already present, it starts really from zero. In other words, there seems to be coexistence here with magnetism all along and superconductivity. Now, the other measurement that's relevant to look at is the magnetoresistance. And as I mentioned earlier, these measurements were done on the same sample, so the same batch that our sample was from. TC is 5.5 Kelvin, and the blue curve is in the superconducting state. As a function of temperature, the conductivity rises, and here it goes superconducting around 5 Kelvin. So this is the superconducting behavior, and the conductivity is around 1,000 inverse ohm centimeters. in the normal state. Now at 4 Tesla, it's roughly similar in value, so we assume that this is a somewhat of a ticklish problem. Are we above HC2 or are we above HC1? And I would say, I would suggest that perhaps we're above HC2 here, because the resistivity looks very similar to normal state here. And of course, there is flux flow resistance and various obscure effects that occur between HC1 and HC2. So we're not guaranteed that we're actually in the normal state, but I think it's likely that we are. And then as the field is raised to 15 Tesla, the resistivity drops. Now that's an interesting effect, because there's been a feeling that what happens here in high fields to the resistivity in a normal state is localization. It was found by Bobinger early on that the material seemed to become resistant once the field was high enough. And you could certainly see that happening here. As you raise the field, the conductivity drops. And of course, they work with the higher doping levels, but it's not clear what happened. But I think it's important to look at spectroscopy to settle this question. And as I will show you, it is not localization, but something else that's happening here. Now, let me just show you what the normal state looks like in this material. This is from Dmitry Basov's group. They did some careful work. This particular sample has a doping of 0.04, so it's probably not superconducting, but it gives you a rough idea what's going on here. There's a very complex spectrum. They had a D-twin crystal. This is the A-axis direction, this is the B-axis direction, and we're plotting optical conductivity as a function of frequency on a logarithmic scale. And there's a lot of structure in this low-frequency region that we're interested in. It's somewhat anisotropic, but there's a definite peak around 100 wave numbers here, and they interpret this as due to a stripe order. Now, stripes give rise to peaks in optical conductivity. If you have two different conductivity regions geometrically separated, you get two plasma frequencies, and you get a transverse plasma at this frequency. And the location of the transverse plasma depends on the amplitude of that modulation. And this kind of effect is seen in YBCO as well, and it's been related to this checkerboard order that's seen, which also has about a 5% modulation. So it's not necessarily an important effect, but it nevertheless is something that appears in these samples and should be taken into account. So these are all in the zero field state, okay, at various temperatures all the way down to 13 Kelvin. Now let me start now by showing our data, our reflectance data. We're measuring optical reflectance, and to keep things simple, I just show four different curves. And I'm going to show these same curves for different types of optical constants, but the same conditions. And the green curve is the normal state. This is measurement at 0 Tesla, 20 Kelvin, well above TC, and the reflectance looks like a typical bad metal. In other words, around 90% and rising towards zero frequency. The green point is DC resistivity extrapolated to this frequency. In other words, the Drude reflectance would go like this and end up at this green point. And the other three are, this is a superconducting state, the blue curve. The reflectance has gone up because of the screening by the condensate mainly. So this is a superconducting state. This is 4 Kelvin at 0 Tesla, not much below TC, which is 5.5 Kelvin. And then the purple curve is 4 Kelvin, 4 Tesla. And now you notice the reflectances drop way down and still looks like a very bad metal here. And the red curve is finally at 16 Tesla, where there's been a further drop in reflectance. Now, reflectance itself is not as useful as is conductivity. So this shows the optical conductivity. And let's first start with the green curve, which is the 20 Kelvin normal state. And it's got quite a bit of structure here, as you can see. And this is not noise. These are real structures. And I think that they're related to the stripe border that was seen in the lower doped samples in Vasov's group. They're in the same frequency range, and because it's a stripe border, static stripes in a certain direction, they would be anisotropic. So this would be perpendicular to the stripes, these would be parallel stripes in a different frequency. This is one of the peaks that that Vasov observed. This is the other one. And they're not particularly strong, as you can see here, not as strong as he sees. So the stripe border seems to be getting weaker as we move towards higher doping. And now this green curve is the normal state, and then the blue curve is the superconductive state. And you notice that there's a gap that develops here. And we think this is the superconducting gap. The conductivity drops at finite frequencies. And the purple curve is the 4 Tesla curve, and you notice that it also has a gap, and it has a little peak. It's a little bit hard to resolve it from the stripe border peak. And then the red one, however, is clearly a much stronger peak at 16 Tesla, and a gap is really well developed here. Now, what kind of gap is this? I can give you some more of it shortly, but one of the signatures of a spin density wave gap is that spectral weight is conserved. In other words, spectral weight that's removed from the gap is pushed to region above the gap. It doesn't go to very high frequencies as it does with, for example, the pseudo gap and other gaps having to do with strong correlation. Instead, it's conserved right in the neighborhood of the gap. This is seen, for example, in the electron dope superconductors and in the organic superconductors. This is a very well-known behavior of a spin density wave gap, and the charge density wave gap for that matter. Okay, so, but this is still not too easy to convince anyone that we've seen a very clear gap. So what we did in order to reduce this stripe border, which is not particularly temperature dependent in this range, was to subtract the normal state conductivity from the other three curves. And that's shown in the next diagram. Now here, we plotted the difference between the conductivity to the normal state. So the normal state is equal to zero here. And in the superconducting state, you can see that this gap has developed. It's rather broad here and getting deeper as you move to lower frequencies. And there's a reduction in conductivity. But there's no recovery of conductivity. And now once we go to 4 Kelvin, I'm sorry, once we go to 4 Tesla, these are measurements at 4 Kelvin. And once we go to 4 Tesla, which is the purple curve, you can see a structure developing here and a small gap. Now, if we are really in a true normal state, then this is a spin density wave gap. And this is a transfer of spectral weight from here to here. You notice this little thing building up here. At 16 Tesla, it's much more obvious. The gap is much deeper, and the transfer spectral weight is much stronger. So we will use this. Later on, we'll use this feature here as a measure of the order parameter of the spin density wave gap. Because it's here, it's a little harder to see where to take the position of the strength of the gap, but here we'll use this amplitude here as an order parameter. Okay, let's compare these results with a magnetoresistance. So these are the points of the conductivity optically measured, low frequency optical conductivity, and DC conductivity here at this same temperature measured by Hawthorne on the same sample. So you notice that it accounts completely for the reduction in conductivity. In other words, the reason the conductivity is going down and the reason the resistance is going up in these materials is the development of a gap in the density of states, as you can see here. Now, the gap doesn't go entirely to zero, and we can assume that if we increase the field, maybe it will go to, the conductivity will go to zero, and we'll get something closer to an insulator. So Bobinger's suggestion that the reduction in conductivity is due to localization is not correct, because if I go back, the connectivity for a localized situation, usually if you have a Drude peak, it will go down a little bit and go to half value. We've done this. We've done experiments where we radiated cistrons, introduced impurities, and into a high TC Coupe rates, and we find that in a normal state, the Drude peak is reduced here, and it goes down about half of its maximum value. This is typical of what happens in materials with very large impurity concentrations. And we don't see that evidence here. Instead, we see a gap. We don't see this Drude peak that's been shifted to finite frequencies. Okay, so now let me go to compare it with the neutron measurements. These are the neutron data for the magnetization, and the red curve is what they found. Now, these two scales are not to be compared directly with one another, because we're just measuring these order parameters I defined earlier, and it, the only thing that's comparable is the magnetic field and the relative changes. And I've just got 2 points here. We actually have made some more measurements since then, and we're going to fill this in a little bit better. We have more field values in the lower end, done in Estonia, where they can go up to 12 Tesla. But you notice there is a difference. The neutron scattering measurements seem to saturate, whereas ours seem to go up linearly. Well, like I said earlier, I expect it to saturate eventually as well, because the gap will not, the entire spectral weight will be used up. There isn't an infinite amount of spectral weight available.
How do you get the moment from your measurement?
Magnetic moment? No, we don't measure, I'm sorry, we're not plotting magnetic moment here. The red curve is the magnetic moment measured by neutron scatter. Okay? And the blue curve is our order parameter, which is the height of the transferred spectral wave. Okay, now, I should one point that I neglected to mention was the why do we know that we have superconductivity? Well, that's shown here, where I plot the dielectric function as a function of frequency. And again, I have the same four colors. The green curve is the normal state, and I haven't subtracted anything here. These are absolute values. And the blue is the superconducting state. And you see that the dielectric function goes negative, as it should for a superconductor, because there's a delta function spectral weight at the origin, which causes this to go negative. On the other side, the spectral weight goes positive, which is characteristic of a non-superconducting system. So we know that we have superconductivity here and no superconductivity here, I would say, unless it's very weak. Okay, now one of the ways to characterize a system like this that's very useful is to look at the accumulated spectral weight. That is, you integrate the spectral weight as a function of frequency. And that often is a useful way of looking at the data. And so that's what we've done here. This is frequency, and this is the accumulated spectral weight, which is sort of number of states per copper atom. And if you had a Drude absorption that's very broad, and that's what we have in a normal state, it's a very weak, strong scattering system where the conductivity is almost frequency independent. And that means that the spectral weight will rise linearly. As you add up this constant, it rises linearly as a function of frequency. And that's the green curve at 20 Kelvin in normal state. Shown here. There is some change here, but in the slope, but it's pretty well, when the Drude peak is exhausted, it gets a little bit different slope. And it's expanded here on the low end. The green curve is a straight line. Now, the dashed curve is the fourth Tesla curve, and you notice there's been a reduction of spectral weight that's at that, and it's not very clear. But if you go to 16 Tesla, you see the clear reduction in spectral weight. But what's more important is that the spectral weight is recovered and goes back to the original Doodle value by the time you reach 200. What that is telling you in what I already told you earlier is that the spectral weight from the gap region is transferred above the gap here and is completely recovered here. So that means that there's just been a shift of spectral weight from one part to the other. Now the blue curve is the superconducting state, and there's also a loss of spectral weight, which is actually magnitude very similar to what's lost in this gap at 16 Tesla, but it's not recovered. You notice that it remains below the other spectral wave. So we've lost spectral wave here permanently. So where did they go? Went to the delta function at the origin. That's the sum rule. Spectral wave can't be lost. It's got to be recovered somewhere. And in a superconductor, it goes to the delta function at the origin. And we saw that already because epsilon 1 went to negative values, indicating there was something going on at the origin. So what we can say here for sure is that we are in a superconducting state at 4 Tesla. At 4 Kelvin, 0 Tesla. And we do lose the spectral wave to within a high degree of accuracy in a superconducting state, but we do not lose it even at 4 Tesla in the normal state. It was completely recovered because all the curves are convergent together here. So I don't think there is any superconductivity, or at least there's no evidence here of superconductivity at 4 Tesla. So we are in a normal state at 4 Tesla, and even more so at 16 Tesla. Now another interesting point here is that if you look at the amount of spectral weight involved here, it's pretty well the same for the spin density wave gap at 16 Tesla as it is for the superconducting gap. And that somehow implies, at least within small factors, that the same electrons are involved. So if there's a piece of Fermi surface that's left in the system at this doping level, then those same electrons are going either superconducting or going into the spin density wave. Okay, well, this is sort of work in progress. We still have more data. We're analyzing it, but I thought I would talk about it just to promote our system, and hoping that if some other people have some interesting samples or interesting problems that require magnetic fields, that we can do that. And I'm hoping to get the system at McMaster going as well, because we have the 18 Tesla magnet all ready to go, waiting for our insert to get fixed up. And I hope the magnet lab will someday build something similar. I guess that's about it. I just want to summarize that we have now a new setup for 18 Tesla that's been operating on and off for some time. We can do 1.8 Kelvin optical measurements, and at the underdoped LSCO at the doping level of 0.06 shows a field-induced gap. And the spectral weight is conserved, and the order parameter is probably spin density wave order, and the spectral weight at 16 Tesla equals the superconducting spectral weight. Finally, I'd like to thank Young C. Kwang, who was the main experimentalist in this collaboration. Thank you.
Thanks very much.